It's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. I haven't yet gotten around to taking my kids to A Wrinkle in Time. So far, I have more wrinkles than time, but I'm looking forward to it. And this book is 50 years old now. When it came out, it was the first time that a lot of young girls had seen themselves represented in the sciences. This book opened up the universe to generations of young women who'd go on to do extraordinary things, including University of Washington Assistant Professor of Astronomy Emily Levesque. Welcome to KUOW, Emily. When did you first know that you wanted to be an astronomer?
I think I knew I wanted to be an astronomer when I was about 2 years old.
2 years old?
Yes. I was 2 years old in 1986, which was the last time Halley's Comet made its close pass by Earth.
Uh-huh.
I have a brother who's 10 years older than me, and he was asked to observe the comet for a school project. So he and I and my parents all went traipsing out into the backyard, and apparently I was just fascinated by the night sky. So after that, people would ask me what I wanted to be when I grew up, and I'd say, oh, I'm going to be a ballerina or an astronomer, or I'm going to be a firefighter or an astronomer, and astronomer's what stuck.
What do you think it was that stuck with you, whereas my kids don't think about constellations as much as they used to?
I think I just got curious. I think the little kid curiosity that everybody has focused on the night sky very early for me, and then my parents fed it with reading and with books.
Which brings us to Wrinkle in Time. How did that book come into your life?
I read that book for the first time when I was about 8 years old. I was an early reader and a really enthusiastic reader, and my mom is a children's librarian, so she was constantly trying to find books that were challenging for me to read but weren't at a maturity level above an eight-year-old. And A Wrinkle in Time was perfect for that. So she gave that book to me, and I just devoured it and loved it and read it and reread it over and over.
What did you love about A Wrinkle in Time?
I loved that it was a book about science and that it was a book that was using physics as a tool for exploring the universe. I loved that it featured kids who were interested in science and who maybe were a little bit different. And that difference and that love for science actually wound up powering the story and really being a driving force and making them protagonists. I thought that was so cool.
Yes, Meg is the main character, and she's kind of awkward and, right? She's struggling.
Yeah, she has glasses, which I identified with as a kid. She is not popular in school. She butts heads with her teachers and her peers and is just seen as odd and this troublesome kid. And in reality, she just works in a different way. And I think as somebody who got teased in school for being the kid interested in science, it was so awesome to see a character like that as a hero.
You could relate to Meg?
Yes, very much so.
We should probably describe the plot just lightly for people who don't know the book and now the movie.
Yeah, so the storyline starts with Meg and her younger brother, Charles Wallace. And when it opens, we learn that their father is a scientist who has disappeared several years ago. And their mother, who is also a scientist, is assuring them, well, he's away for something related to his research. I'm sure he'll be back. And they're wondering what's become of him. And Charles Wallace introduces these three sort of mystical beings into their lives, Mrs. What's-It, Mrs. Who, and Mrs. Which.
Mm-hmm.
And they wind up taking the children on this journey through the universe to find and rescue their father, and the story spirals from there.
I read it when I was very young. I read parts of it to my daughter a couple of years ago. I didn't realize the science was so important. These creatures, they're flying around, and they used to be stars, and to me, it might as well have been Glinda the Good Witch floating on a bubble, but it's actually quite scientific.
Well, the core science of the book and the mechanism they use to travel through the universe actually is rooted in physics. The main thing that we hear about in the book is something called a tesseract.
Right.
And they describe that as how they travel through the universe. And it invokes this idea that space-time as we know it is four-dimensional. That's how we're used to seeing it. There's the three dimensions that we can see and touch, and then there's the fourth dimension, which is time. The tesseract makes use of the idea that there's a fifth dimension and that you can wrinkle space-time into that extra dimension, and it's like folding up a piece of paper or bending a string, which is the little hand-drawn illustration they show in the book. And by doing that, you can travel between points in the universe that appear to be great distances apart. It's close to what we would think of today as a wormhole. Anyone who's actually seen the movie Interstellar has seen examples of using something like that to travel through the universe.
I'm talking with Assistant Professor of Astronomy at the UW, Emily Levesque. We're talking about A Wrinkle in Time, and I wonder how, which the book and now the movie, do you find that literature has informed the way you think of your astronomy work?
Oh, very much so. I read A Wrinkle in Time when I was very young. I read Carl Sagan when I was young. And there are many writers who do a wonderful job of synthesizing science and the art of literature. It's funny because I sometimes hate the idea that there are creative and artsy people and there are science and math people and they're very separate things, because in my experience, there's so much overlap there. Being able to verbalize and explain the science that we do is such a crucial part of scientists' day-to-day lives. And the creativity that comes to bear in writing is also so important for doing science. You need to be able to think of creative ways of looking at data or creative ways of asking questions. So I think that these two things are very tightly connected.
So why do we have that idea of the mathematician or the scientist as the uncreative wonk?
I don't know. I think that part of it comes from the idea that these things have been taught separately. And for a long time in school, the subjects were treated separately. And we're now hearing about things like STEAM, so science, technology, engineering, arts, and mathematics. And hopefully that's changing. And communicating science can be very challenging. We are, as scientists, used to thinking of a lot of concepts in terms of numbers and equations or mental visuals. And I actually love the exercise of trying to explain it very plainly, but it's hard. And it's a skill that I know a lot of scientists now are placing even more priority on.
In A Wrinkle in Time, there's the idea we meet three beings who used to be stars, right? They kind of chose to stop being stars and fight the darkness, something like that?
Yes. In the book, Mrs. Wetzet actually talks about this, that she was a star who, I think the depiction is, she sort of exploded or died this very luminous death to fight a darkness that's encroaching on the universe.
Yes. And meanwhile, you discovered three stars, the three largest stars in the known universe. You discovered those as an undergrad?
Yes. I discovered those during research that I did while I was an undergrad at MIT. Yeah.
That's amazing. And do you see any connection between these stars in A Wrinkle in Time and your discovery?
I actually think that I would not have been involved in that project and would not have discovered those stars if it hadn't been for A Wrinkle in Time. Because when I read A Wrinkle in Time, it immediately sucked me into this idea of traveling through the universe and tesseracts and bending space, which in astronomy leads you directly to black holes. So even when I was starting my undergraduate career, I was fascinated by the idea of black holes. And I got very curious about how we make this transition from stars that are massive, but perhaps otherwise not that weird, to these objects that they form after they die, like black holes. So after my sophomore year of college, I got the chance to work with an astronomer named Philip Massey at Lowell Observatory, which is in Flagstaff, Arizona. And he offered me two different research projects and asked me to pick one. And one was working on blue supergiant stars, and the other was working on red supergiants. It sounds like a really superficial difference, but I knew that blue supergiants were very young, newly born stars, and red supergiants were very evolved stars that were getting ready to die and possibly make black holes. So I picked that project almost on a whim, going, it's closer to black holes, I'll like it. And those stars, by definition, are enormous. So working on that project is how we wound up discovering the three largest stars that anybody had seen in the universe. And I wouldn't have picked that project if I hadn't had this long-seated fascination with black holes.
And A Wrinkle in Time was part of that.
Very much so.
You mentioned that a thing about the book that stands out is that math and science doesn't seem to have anything to do with gender. You know, Meg is excellent at math. Her father is a scientist. Her mother is a brilliant scientist. When you were growing up in the 80s, you said, right?
Mm-hmm.
Was it common for girls to get that message?
I think that it was not as common as it should have been. I think I was very lucky in that as I was growing up, my family never treated me like a girl who liked science and never made an issue of my gender. I was a kid who liked science and who was interested in astronomy and digging for dinosaur bones in the backyard. And I think that lack of emphasis helped me just be a kid and just be a scientist. And I like seeing that reflected now when I go back and read the book, that there are clearly scientists in the book whose gender is not a factor. I think when I read it as a kid, I was mostly interested in Meg and her little brother. But now I see how nice it is that there was this brilliant woman scientist who was also a mom and who was just simply there and is a linchpin of the story, that I think in retrospect, it's good to have a character like that present and sort of showing readers, yep, it's completely normal to grow up and be a scientist regardless of gender.
And what kind of messages do you see kids getting today?
I hope that they're getting that message louder and clearer. I think that the fact that this movie has been made will help that. I think kids seeing other kids like themselves on screen and seeing that an interest in science is wonderful and should be nourished is a wonderful message.
There's also the element of Meg that is non-conforming. The book is very much about conformity too.
Yes.
She's stubborn and like the evil force kind of wants you to conform with the big mind.
Yeah. I think I might have, as a kid, identified with her not conforming at least as much as I did with her gender.
Yeah.
Because I liked that she was not a perfect character. She's not always brave, and she can be mouthy, and she can have a bit of an attitude. And those are all, I think, really familiar to anybody who's ever been 13. And seeing that that just made her a whole person really made me like her as a character. It avoided the message that we can sometimes give of you have to be perfect to grow up to be what you want to be. And it doesn't say, you know, don't try to fix things and improve, but it says be who you are wholly. Don't try to fit into this very narrow profile of what a woman can be or what a scientist can be.
Yeah, when I was a kid, a big book to read was Heidi. Have you ever heard of that book?
Oh, yes.
And Heidi is also, you know, is the happy one and the prevailing one, but boy, is she she's perfect, but also kind of a take care of other people type of person. And some of us are caretakers, but some of us aren't always.
So something that struck me when I was watching the movie in particular is it's so nice to see a fully realized character like that. I mean, the actress who plays Meg in the movie, Storm Reid, she's just wonderful. And you get the full mix of characters from her. She's not just a girl. She's not just a scientist. She can be upset. She can be ecstatically happy. She can be scared. A couple of weeks ago, I also went to see Black Panther and the character of Shuri. I felt like there were so many connections between her and Meg. And it's not just that they're both young women of color, and it's not both that they're brilliant scientists. They have sometimes butting heads in relationships with the other adults in their lives. They're fiercely protective of their brothers. They're interested in science. They have a little bit of mischief in them. And seeing these characters realized as people and full complex characters, I think makes them click more with anybody watching who's thinking, oh, I'm stubborn like that. Or sometimes people pick on me for that. And it just makes them more vivid role models.
Talking about A Wrinkle in Time, and now a couple more questions for Assistant Professor of Astronomy at UW, Emily Levesque. One is, if you could wave a magic wand over our current science culture, what would you change?
That's a great question. One thing that I've always wanted to do is get as many people excited about science as possible. And I think that that's more than just showing somebody a cool image from Hubble or showing them a snippet of how science works. I want everybody to understand why we do the research that we do, how the research is done, because there are fascinating stories, even within astronomy, of how people use telescopes and make discoveries. I really want to bring to the forefront the idea that science is done by people and by humans, and that this passion and curiosity is really what's driving scientists. So much of that directly creates the types of discoveries that we make, and having more understanding of that, having as a result more financial support for science, is only going to sort of help how science is done and really help humanity.
Yeah, so depict science as the human story that it is. It's not just gears turning.
Yes.
Which brings us back to A Wrinkle in Time. I'd like to know what you thought of the movie.
I just went to go see it, and I knew going in that it was going to be very different than the image that I had in my mind. I'd actually talked to some people who were saying, oh, I don't know if I want to go see it. I pictured it so differently.
And I've heard that.
I was actually really excited for that because everybody has their own picture of a book in their head when they go to see a movie. And I was really excited to see something different. The book itself, as you read it, is really cerebral. It spends time, in some cases, very literally inside people's minds.
Yes.
And obviously, a movie has to use different tools of storytelling. And the approach that was taken here was so richly visual that it was fascinating to see this colorful world on screen, see depictions of the different planets that they visit. It was just so wild to see the version of the book that had come out of the directors and the creative team's heads. And there was an amazing attention to detail within the movie where you could really tell that it had come from people who read and loved the book.
Oh, that's good to hear.
There's a scene when the children first arrive on Kamazots, which is this planet that is, for lack of a better word, it's sort of controlled by a hive mind.
Mm-hmm.
And they're in this very creepy, perfect programmed suburb. And
the kids are bouncing the red balls.
Exactly. It's a scene in the trailer. And if you listen when you watch the movie, there's a dog barking and a bird chirping in the background. And they are on a loop.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same bark and the same chirp every time. And those little details are clearly put in there by a team that read that scene, and it made as much of an impression on them as it did on other readers, and they wanted to pass that creepy, this isn't quite right feeling onto viewers.
Did the science survive?
The science actually is a bit changed in the movie. They invoke a different mechanism for how tesseracts work, but there's some really nice science in there. The very opening scene is a younger Meg and her dad using something called a Chladni plate, which is a pretty classic physics demonstration where you put sand on a plate and then vibrate it at different frequencies, and the resonant frequencies of the plate give you these amazing patterns as the sand on the plate settles into sort of still regions. And they combine that and the idea of quantum entanglement to explain the tesseract, which is very different from the book, but I think makes for some really great visuals because, again, it's a visual medium, so you want something that you can depict for an audience in a very vivid way.
I don't suppose you would give it 3 stars? How many stars?
I don't think I want to give it a star rating. I think that I want people to go see it as its own creative entity and then hopefully read the book as well and get these two different versions of a really great story.
Emily Levesque, assistant astronomy professor, University of Washington, discoverer of the 3 largest stars in the known universe. I hope that all scientists and children and grown-ups share the love of story that you clearly have. I just love listening to you.
Oh, thank you. I try to do this when I talk about my own research, any type of science. People respond to stories and respond to storytelling, so you want to depict that science as a story. I've had people tell me that some of the research that we do sounds like a mystery novel where you ask a question and you go seek out the answer, but that really is what it is.
Emily Levesque, it's a pleasure. Thanks.
Thank you.
And Dr. Levesque goes into much more detail about how the book A Wrinkle in Time inspired her in an upcoming podcast called The Deep, produced by Moment Magazine. This is The Record on KUOW Seattle.